From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison.
All members vote who desire to vote.
Members, this budget is not our preference.
Share the pain.
We got to stop the game.
No baloney.
Taxes, taxes, taxes.
The next step's the governor's.
Only the good Lord knows.
Mr. Secretary, call the roll.
It's Friday and time for Capital Chat, our weekly segment about what's going on in California government. This week, we'll focus on the big pile of legislation on Governor Brown's desk. He has until Sunday to act on hundreds of bills, big and small. Joining us to talk about what's already signed or vetoed and about the bills whose fate is still unknown is Capital Public Radio state government reporter Ben Adler. He's at our Capital Bureau downtown. Ben, welcome back to the show.
Good morning. I am digging out of a pile of bills that we get from the governor's office most every day this week, although it's nothing compared to what's to come with about 300 more to act on by Sunday at midnight.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about what's to come, but let's spend a couple of minutes on some of the bills that the governor has signed so far.
Yeah, sure. Let's just take yesterday, for example. Maybe three dozen measures or so he signed. He vetoed a couple of them. And the measures kind of ranged from everything that would deal with the state's regulatory system to food stamps. And one of the main bills that got some attention yesterday, a bill that we highlighted, is one that Democratic legislative leaders reached a deal with some of the state business groups like the California Chamber of Commerce on about a month ago to deal with the state's regulatory system in terms of making it more transparent and requiring regulations to have economic impact assessments. And supporters of the measure say that it will really help deal with some of the economic uncertainty that California businesses have to deal with. Republicans say it's a perfectly good first step, but doesn't go far enough. And I have to point out that the bill takes effect in November 2013. So as far as it making any immediate impact on economy, the economy in California, I guess it probably won't.
We could be well into the next economic cycle by then, but that's another matter.
Yeah, exactly. There are a bunch of other bills the governor's been signing on. For example, a couple of measures, I think four, that deal with maternity care for both pregnant women and mothers. Capital Public Radio's healthcare reporter Pauline Bartolone has a feature up at capradio.org that takes a look at the impact a couple of those would have. Also, measures to eliminate the fingerprinting requirement for food stamp applicants and crack down on cell phone use in state prisons. All that and much more he acted on just yesterday alone.
Now, what about bills the governor's vetoed?
The one this week that really got the most attention is a bill that was very strongly supported by unions and opposed even more strongly, if possible, by Republicans. It's a bill that would have allowed California's child care workers to unionize. And it is a law in many other states, but the governor said, this is a bad time to do it given the state's financial situation because it would have increased child care costs to the state. He said it's always important to balance the importance of quality working conditions and the state's economy, and right now just didn't make sense to him. And here's what the SEIU's Michael Cox had to say in response.
These child care providers, mostly women, are most certainly not babysitters. They wake up 5:30 in the morning. They work sometimes until 10 o'clock at night so that working families throughout this state can go to work. The child care that they deliver keeps California working, and any attempt to call them babysitters is really just demeaning them in their profession.
So that was a bill he's vetoed. When this whole process started, it seemed like Governor Brown suggested that he might be vetoing quite a few bills. He expressed impatience several times in different ways about the nature and the quantity of legislation that was coming to him. But it seems like he hasn't vetoed that many yet.
You know, he hasn't. He's vetoed maybe 50 bills or so out of the 550 or so that he's acted on so far this year. There are certainly still 300 bills left on his desk, and he could at any time unleash a big flurry of them. In fact, Evan Westrup in the governor's press office told me earlier this week, don't count your chickens before they hatch. But I called up Joe Matthews, who is the New America Foundation Senior Irvine Fellow. He's followed California politics quite closely, has a book on Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger that he wrote several years back. And I asked him, well, why is it that a governor might, or this governor in particular, might say there aren't 600 problems that need solutions and then sign a whole bunch of them into law.
The governor probably has to pick fights. If you're looking at a lot of stuff that doesn't really matter much to you as a governor, do you want to veto because you think it's meaningless and risk making life harder for yourself when you need a vote from that legislator who sponsored the bill later? Or do you want to just go along and say, hey, this isn't going to do me any harm, and it may make life a little easier for me when I need a vote from a legislator? And a governor has to be really careful not to upset people unnecessarily, because you really need big supermajorities to get anything of significance done in California. For all the talk and rhetoric and the sense of saying, yeah, there aren't probably 600 urgent problems, when you get down to vetoing on many things, unless it's something that really bothers you or you think is a big mistake, governors are going to take the path of least resistance.
Well, that's what Joe Matthews says, who's was a journalist and he's now a political analyst. What about Republicans? What have they made, generally speaking, to Governor Brown's approach to the legislation?
I asked Senate Republican leader Bob Dutton to grade the governor, and he said, I have to give an incomplete until we see all the other measures that he's dealt with. But he and other Republicans are keeping an especially close watch on bills that they believe would impact the economy. And so one bill that the governor signed this week that I have not mentioned yet is a bill that would ban the chemical BPA in baby bottles and sippy cups. And that's a bill that Republicans were really keeping an eye on. They feel it's unnecessary, that the state already has a process for evaluating chemicals, and that the legislature shouldn't be jumping in the middle of that. The governor signed that bill without any comment. It was just one on a big list of bills that came out. And so for every child care unionization bill that is vetoed that the Republicans are pleased with, there's a BPA bill that's signed that they're displeased with. And here's how Senator Bob Huff, a Republican from Southern California, summed it up when I asked him.
He's not vetoing as many as the previous governor did, but on the other hand, he has taken care of some pretty egregious bills. Some have come through, but, you know, the voters elected Jerry Brown. He has a different outlook, and he's reflecting that.
And I understand the Republicans have also been reacting to the governor's pithy messages, because it's been kind of entertaining sometimes to read the governor's messages where he explains the action that he's taken on the various legislation that go on his desk.
Yeah, this is actually a great idea that our Capitol reporter Jenny O'Mara had, and she'll have a story with some analysis of what the governor's doing from with a quote from Republican leader Dutton and from a political analyst at USC coming up Monday on Morning Edition. But yeah, you know, so we asked a couple of Republicans what they thought, Bob Dutton and Bob Huff, and, you know, bemusement for the most part is kind of their reaction, but also a feeling that the governor is being a bit disingenuous when he criticizes Republicans for their unwillingness to deal with taxes. For example, there is a bill dealing with state parks that Senator Tom Harmon, a Republican from Orange County, authored, and the governor vetoed that, saying the bill was a good idea, but not one that needs a law. He went on to say what the bill really needs, or what the parks really need, are funding, something that I feel compelled to point out that the author and his Republican colleagues weren't willing to do. So Senate Republicans believe that they were willing to place tax extensions on the ballot if the governor agreed to changes in pensions and regulations and a state spending cap, and they feel that Democrats and their union allies killed that deal, not Republicans. So keep that in mind. Here's what I first we hear from Senator Dutton, then Senator Huff, and Huff kind of references an acrostic message that came out a little bit vulgar from Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger as he compares Brown's veto messages to Schwarzenegger's.
I think sometimes they're a little too cute. I mean, you can always do a counterpoint to some of the things that he has indicated. I just don't happen to believe, and I would say that my caucus doesn't believe this either, that you can tax your way out of a recession.
Well, I think the former governor had his own unique messaging style, including some hidden messages in there. You know, I mean, the governor's being the governor. It's just what he does. It's fine.
Now, the governor has acted in one way or another on lots of bills, but as you said earlier, there's a whole bunch still awaiting action. Can you give us some idea of what's still left to be signed or vetoed?
Yeah, and I can actually tell you right now that so far this morning, the governor has signed a handful of bills dealing with water, and he just sent out an email about five more that deal with pipeline safety in the aftermath of the San Bruno PG&E gas pipeline explosion from last year. That still leaves about 300 to go. Probably the biggest one that's attracting most of the attention or suspense would require all future ballot measures to go before voters in general elections, not primaries, and that would likely give Democrats a more favorable voter base for future political battles at the polls. That's another big union versus business, Democrat versus Republican bill that the governor is going to have to come down on one side or the other, and he can't really deal with shades of gray on that. It's either a signing or a veto. There are bills that would allow things like online voter registration in time for next year's election and state financial aid for college students who are undocumented immigrants. There are bills that would ban things like the sale or possession of shark fins, openly carrying a handgun in public, tanning bed use for minors, cell phones in prisons, and also banning grocery stores from selling alcohol in self-checkout lanes. Most of those measures, not all, most were passed by majority Democrats over strong Republican opposition. And so we will see. Midnight Sunday, the deadline for the governor to act. That is at the end of Sunday, the start of Monday. And so it'll be a long weekend for everyone in the governor's office. They will not be taking the weekend off.
And just so people are clear here, if the governor does not sign a bill that goes before him by this weekend, does that mean the bill is dead?
No, the opposite. It means it becomes law without the governor acting one way or the other.
And if he vetoes it, then it is dead. Although we're only halfway through a legislative session.
Yeah, you know, in theory, the legislature can override governor's vetoes.
Yes, but that's it'll
take a two-thirds vote for it. But there are some bills that he's vetoed, like that state parks one authored by Senator Harmon that I mentioned earlier. That, I believe, had very strong, well over two-thirds support, if not unanimous support. I'd have to go back and check the vote count. And so, you know, if the legislature wants to go ahead and override that veto, it certainly could.
Well, that sounds like the topic of a whole nother Capital Chat segment.
Well, fortunately, we have these every week.
We do. Ben Adler, Capital Public Radio state government reporter, joining us for our weekly Friday segment, Capital Chat. Ben, thanks so much.
Sure, no problem.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, why Central Valley scientists are creating a huge network of wireless sensors in a Sierra Nevada river basin. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Joining us with details about what's online with Insight is Insight's Jen Picard. Hi, Jen.
Hi, good morning. So this week, we spoke with both opponents and proponents of AB 499, a bill still before Governor Jerry Brown that would allow teenagers aged 12 and older to get the HPV vaccine without parental consent. Tim from Camino wrote, "Parents should not be against a 12-year-old being able to independently get this vaccination from a licensed physician or RN any more than being against their ability to acquire condoms. Parents need to be realistic. The world is as it is, not as it should be. I'm assuming they don't want their daughter to get pregnant or get cervical cancer. Above all, parents need to sit down and have a serious private discussion with their 11 or 12-year-old daughters about the risks of premature sexual activity. Parents must take responsibility for making sure that their children are well informed about things that can seriously affect the rest of their lives. Apparently, this is an obligation that many of today's young parents are shirking."
Well, a lot of very strong feelings and opinions on both sides of this issue.
Definitely. We'll see if the governor actually signs it into law or vetoes it next week. Later in today's show, we'll be talking with representatives of Occupy Sacramento who are protesting in Cesar Chavez Park. We asked our Facebook fans this morning if they were participating or planning to participate and what they hope to accomplish. Christina wrote, "I'm as involved as much as I can be. I'm hoping that these worldwide protests encourage politicians to develop some ethical values. They have an obligation to defend the well-being of our people, and this country has been neglected for too long. Unfortunately, the spectrum of this nation nations need is too broad and confusing for most to understand. In its simplicity, what I hope this accomplishes is the separation of corporation and state and the redevelopment of a checks and balances system that meets our modern needs. If you have any comments or want to see what others have to say, go to our Facebook page, Insight on Capital Public Radio, or send an email to insight@capradio.org.
Thank you, Jen.
You're very welcome.
There's a lot of information inside the Sierra Nevada snowpack that helps scientists and policymakers know what's going on with the climate at large and figure out how much water will come down into rivers and ultimately into our reservoirs, our farms, and so on. Right now, the snowpack measurement is a relatively simple process and rather limited, but scientists at UC Merced aim to change that. They recently were awarded a large federal grant to start work on a huge network of wireless sensors in the Sierra Nevada. Joining us is the leader of this effort. He's Dr. Roger Bales, director of the Sierra Nevada Research Institute and professor at the UC Merced School of Engineering. Roger Bales, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, and good morning.
What exactly will these wireless sensors tell us?
They will tell us the depth of snow across the basin. Right now, the measurements are limited to a few areas, generally flat meadow areas. So we will be sampling the landscape in a more representative manner, north-facing slopes, south-facing slopes, higher, lower elevations, in the forest, out in the open, and we'll also have sensors for soil moisture.
Now, the current techniques for measuring the snowpack depth, you refer to people going to these meadows, and this is something we've been hearing about for many years in California. A few people go up into a few spots, they got this big measuring stick, essentially, and they check the depth of the snow. These wireless sensors, presumably much more sophisticated, where would the sensors be? Would they be down at ground level?
The sensors would be mounted on a pole high enough so that they would remain above the snowpack.
I see. And how would they know how deep the snowpack is when they're above the snowpack?
The sensors we're using send an acoustic signal downward, and it bounces back from the first surface that it hits. So it would, as the snow builds up, the signal will record that.
Why would this be more accurate than the current system where actual people go there with devices that they stick into the snow?
At one point, it would not be more accurate, but it would give a larger set of values across the basin so we can answer the question of how much snow is out there in the basin on a more accurate way and not just answer the question how much snow is at the index sites where the measurements are made.
My guest is Roger Bales of UC Merced. When you say the basin, which basin are we talking about?
Well, it could be applied to any basin in the Sierra Nevada. Right now, our new project will be in the American River Basin, all three forks, north, south, and middle fork of the American River Basin.
Well, that's a huge area. I believe it's about 2,000 square miles, and a lot of that terrain is hard to get to. It's going to be very steep. Do you plan to put these sensors all over the place?
We won't put them every place. We try to sample the landscape in a representative manner. So if we sample north-facing slopes at 7,000 feet elevation in the one location, we may not have to sample those in another location. So we will strategically sample the basin to get representative values that can then be extended over the basin using a model or interpolation methods.
How many sensors are we talking about?
Roughly 300 to 400 snow sensors.
And how many people are going to plant or place those sensors, and how long will that take?
We hope to place more than half of them next summer. This fall will be selecting the final sites and working through the permitting process. And then as soon as the roads open next summer, we'll get out and try to place as many as we can. The rest we'll place the following summer.
Sounds like some people are going to be doing a lot of hiking.
Yes, although most of these areas are served by Forest Service roads.
Yes. Give us an idea of what these sensors are going to look like when there's no snow.
There'll be a pole that's anywhere from 8 to 12 or 14 feet sticking up. We have been using a 2-inch galvanized pipe that's supported by a U-post. So that'll be the visual impact. There'll also be a very small solar panel to recharge the batteries on the sensor, and then a little box that contains the radio to telemeter the signal out to a mother station so that it can then be transmitted to your computer.
A lot of people go to places like the American River Basin, especially in the high country, to get away from obvious signs of civilization. How intrusive will these be?
We're going to try to build outward from where there are existing measurement sites already. So it will be, in that sense, an incremental impact. But I would say that there's a trade-off between having everything free of visual impacts and having information that's needed to manage the resources.
The Sierra Nevada is hundreds of miles long, and as big as the American River Basin is, that's just one small part, relatively speaking, of the Sierra Nevada. If this were to be expanded across the Sierra, it would be a huge effort, wouldn't it?
I can see replicating that 15 times across the rest of the, or 15 to 20 times across the rest of the Sierra Nevada. But realize that this is still in the research stage. We may find ways to do it with fewer sensors, but right now this is our best estimate that we need this many sensors to get representative values. But yes, people have to decide if there's a need for this information, how valuable is the information. And right now we have the technology to provide better information.
Are these sensors checking the height of the snowpack, or the depth, if that's the more correct word, or are they checking for the water content?
They're checking the depth of the snowpack. To estimate the water content, we use the values from the existing operational networks, the snow pillow network or the snow courses, because density doesn't change that much as you go across the walk across the landscape, whereas depth changes tremendously.
My guest is Roger Bales of UC Merced. Are these sensors intended to help policymakers figure out, and other officials figure out, how much water is going to be coming down off of the mountains to the cities and the farms? Or is this more about climate change research?
This is really to estimate how much water is out there in the snowpack. And then there are, of course, there's a watershed that, and trees and everything else that uses water in between the snowmelt and the river, but it enables using a new generation of hydrologic estimation tools that work with physical quantities of the water rather than the current statistically based forecasts. So it provides a new generation of decision support for people that operate reservoirs, that make water allocations, that do drought planning, that do forest management, and a whole range of other decisions.
Where are you getting the money from?
We have some seed funding through the Department of Water Resources. We've already built two of these of the 20 or so instrument clusters that we plan to deploy in the American River Basin, and we have now a large increment of funding from the National Science Foundation to build that out. We're still talking with other partners to expand the system through the data and information systems that are needed, and we'll also be blending with satellite data.
Well, I was just going to ask you about satellites. Couldn't satellites give you this sort of information?
Satellites tell us where there's snow and where there's no snow. They don't tell us the depth of snow. So we are partnering with NASA, with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, to provide that product going into the future.
Well, I'm certainly no rocket scientist, but don't satellites bounce waves down to Earth for whatever reason, and from that could perhaps figure out the depth of the snow?
Okay, the satellite that's available on a daily basis tell you the reflectance of the surface of the Earth. So obviously snow has a brighter reflectance than trees, so it can tell you, or rocks, so it can tell you where it sees snow. In terms of getting the height of the land surface or height of the snow surface, there are aircraft-based systems that do that, and I know some colleagues who will be testing that in a couple of years in the Sierra Nevada. We've tested it on a one-time base, and it works really well, but there's no routine aircraft to fly around and develop those data, and I don't see any movement to invest in that technology.
And that would be inherently more expensive than having sensors with solar panels.
I believe it would, yeah. I believe it would. But it could provide potentially better information.
I see. Roger Bales, director of the Sierra Nevada Research Institute and professor at the UC Merced School of Engineering. He is the lead in a project to place a network of wireless sensors in the American River Basin to help track the Sierra Nevada snowpack. Roger Bales, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, we'll talk with members of Occupy Sacramento who started protesting at Cesar Chavez Plaza yesterday morning. You're listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. What's in the news today? Joining us with the details is Capital Public Radio senior editor Alan Ray. He's in the newsroom. What's in the news, Alan?
Well, good morning, Jeffrey. First of all, Occupy Sacramento is back. They massed yesterday in reasonable numbers at Cesar Chavez Park downtown, and they were arrested. At least a few of them were arrested last night. They are back today in the park, and the indications are that they will be back no matter how many times the police go out to arrest them. Four U.S. attorneys in California announce enforcement actions targeting what they call the commercial marijuana industry. Among the U.S. attorneys is Ben Wagner, the U.S. attorney in Sacramento. There's a news conference right now going on about that. And apparently what the plan is that they're going to start squeezing, among other things, the people who rent facilities, who rent space to the people who have marijuana operations.
Sounds like a significant development and one that came as a surprise, I think, to people who follow marijuana policy.
Well, it's interesting. There was a report by a guy by the name of Michael Montgomery on the California Report yesterday about the fact that the U.S. attorneys and the U.S. government was going to try some other tactics. And apparently this is one of the tactics that he was referring to then.
Okay.
Also, you may have noticed 103,000 new jobs created last month. And you'd like to say woo-hoo, but the unemployment rate stays at 9.1%. There's no indication the unemployment rate is really going to jostle off that point anytime soon. President Obama had that news conference yesterday. Republicans are not happy still about his plan for creating jobs. All that coming up and more this afternoon, beginning at 3:30 on All Things Considered on Capital Public Radio.
Alan Ray, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, now let's talk a bit more about Occupy Sacramento. We just heard a brief update there from Alan Ray. Occupy Sacramento is part of the national protest movement that started a few weeks ago in New York. They congregated yesterday at Cesar Chavez Plaza in downtown Sacramento. Some were arrested and released, as I understand, but they're back today. Joining us from downtown Sacramento are two members of Occupy Sacramento, Ananda Chowdhury and Aria Rashid. Ananda, Aria, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having us.
Well, let's start with you, Aria. What's your personal goal for Occupy Sacramento? What would you consider a success?
Sure. Well, my personal goal would be hopefully to have this be a mass awareness campaign, essentially hopefully to wake up the public and for this to be kind of a call to action to get involved. We need more dialogue. A lot of people are kind of complacent in this country, and obviously traditional politics doesn't seem to be really solving our problems, or if it is, it's going very slowly. It seems to me it might be going backwards, actually. So it's time for the public to get involved, and that's what I see this entire Occupy the World, Occupy Together movement being at this stage right now. It's sort of just an awareness campaign.
And what about you, Ananda? What's your personal goal, and how would you define success for Occupy Sacramento?
Likewise with Aria, my personal goal is a lot to do with awareness. It seems that a lot of the politicians today don't want to focus on, as we say, the 99%, but rather corporate interests and also interests of political extremes. And I think this is a way for the public to realize that there are a lot of people that care about the future of our country and the world, and just generally everyone is dissatisfied about the economy. And there are many pragmatic solutions that we can do to support and solve those issues.
So
in my opinion, the personal goal would be to have the Sacramento community really get involved with this effort.
You mentioned, I think you said pragmatic solutions, some pragmatic solutions. Could you give us some examples?
Sure. With the Occupy Wall Street movement, they're advocating certain policies that have been already advocated by many in the by many people in Congress and the Senate and the House of Representatives. That includes closing tax loopholes, the Buffett rule, and also reining in on regulation. Dodd-Frank has been a horrible mess. It's been watered down when passed, and now many in Congress are trying to peel away the teeth that it already has.
You're talking about the regulation of the of banks?
Yes.
Yes. Arya, Rashid and Aninda Chowdhury are joining us from downtown Sacramento. They are taking part in the Occupy Sacramento, which is happening in Cesar Chavez Plaza. Arya, were you one of the people arrested last night?
No, I was not. Thankfully, I was not one of the people arrested. The people arrested actually were well aware of the fact that they were going to be arrested. They elected themselves to do so as sort of a show of civil disobedience. Everybody was very peaceful and very cooperative from both sides. That is, the cops, the police, the Sacramento PD, they were very cooperative. The media was very cooperative, and so were the protesters. They were extremely peaceful.
And, they were arrested, I guess, because they were still in Cesar Chavez Plaza, and the police had informed them that the city closes the park at a certain time.
Correct. Yeah, they granted us the right to peacefully assemble and peacefully protest from the hours of, I believe, 5 a.m. to 11 p.m., but we don't have those rights between 11 p.m. and 5 a.m. So that's what they were protesting.
Okay. Aninda, I read somewhere that organizers of Occupy Sacramento were hoping for many hundreds of people, maybe even thousands, yesterday. What's your estimate of how many people were there, and what do you think about that size of crowd, whatever it was?
Well, yesterday it started out with only perhaps 100 people. Throughout the day, it grew to, in my estimate, about 500 to 600 folks. I think that the future of this movement relies upon our ability to spread awareness and educate ourselves about the issues. I think that what happens next is for people to really to come out about this. And what else did you ask?
Well, I think you pretty much answered the question.
Okay.
Arya, let's talk about the politics of all this. Did you vote for, typically for any party, any candidate before this current time?
Sure. I did vote for Obama. I was a supporter during his campaign, but I feel like he didn't follow through with a lot of the things that he said he would implement.
Such
or
as?
That I'll, such as, for example, having a complete, one of the things that he really sold me on was having this completely transparent government. And talking about how I remember him saying that he would broadcast a lot of things on C-SPAN, consistently make sure everybody knows that every bill that would come through, he would post the entire thing up on some website and have everybody look at it. And there was a lot of stuff that he just didn't do. His healthcare plan just seems like it was kind of halfway there, a little bit of patchwork. And ultimately, he hasn't done enough, or his administration hasn't done enough to help sort of the economic problems that we've been having.
So what do you,
especially, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, especially with regard to the wealth gap, which seems to be increasing in this country.
How do you think you'll vote in the election next year?
That's very difficult to say. I'm still going to have to wait and see how things develop. But as of now, I think I share the viewpoint of a lot of people here, which is we're losing a lot of confidence in our elected leaders and the people that are campaigning, because it feels like they say one thing during their campaign and do another thing once they're elected.
Aninda, what about you? How have you voted in the past, assuming you have, and how do you see yourself voting in the future?
I wasn't able to vote in the presidential election. I still was underage at that point. But I did vote in the election just last year, and I voted for my representative, Matsui. But yeah, it's hard to say right now, because a lot of politicians would like to appease many that are out right now protesting. But when it comes down towards after the elections, it sort of goes back to politics as usual in Washington. And that's what here we are here in the Occupy Sacramento movement, but as well as the other Occupy movements, are standing up against.
Arya, do you think there could, should be a third major political party in the United States?
Yes, I do think so. I don't feel like any of the political parties in the United States are currently accurately representing the most of the population. The slogan that we like to use is the 99%. I mean, one example is if you just look at the largest campaign contributors for both Obama and McCain, you see largely the same set of big corporations or institutions, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase, Merrill Lynch, they're all up there. And they kind of put their hands in both sides, and that's kind of discouraging for the people. We don't know who they're working for.
Aninda, when I think about what I've heard about the Occupy movement and what I've heard and know about the Tea Party movement, it seems like these groups are proposing, in many cases, very different solutions. But it also seems that there's a similar motivating frustration with how power is held and implemented in this country. Do you see that kind of parallel?
I do see the parallel between where people draw between the Tea Party and the Occupy movements, but I really believe it's a false equivalency here. I think that the Occupy movement is a larger scope of many Americans in this country. I think that we present a larger population. It's not, we don't have specific, although our goals are different and they stem from economic injustice, we have different strategies. We have different solutions.
Aria, do you have any thoughts on that?
I agree for the most part with Nin. I think that it's still to be determined what happens with this Occupy movement. I don't know if I'd draw a parallel between us or this movement, for example, and the Tea Party. I've heard a lot of talk about it. You know, this might be kind of the Democratic Party's equivalent to the Tea Party. So far, the sentiment that I've seen, that's not really what's in the back of people's minds. They're looking for something much more comprehensive than that. I think people want to transcend the two-party system.
So at least some in the Tea Party seem to want to put pressure on the Republican Party to move more to the right. Are you saying then that the Occupy movement is not about putting pressure on the Democratic Party to move more to the left?
I can't. Were you addressing me or? And then,
well,
I'm
either,
sorry.
Either oh, or ahead. Both.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, in my opinion, I don't think that it's pushing the Democratic Party to the left. I think it's pushing both Republicans and Democrats to address the issue of corporatism and public money, or the lack of public money, into our political system. Mm.
And both of you, what are your plans for today and through the weekend? Do you see yourselves continuing to occupy Cesar Chavez Plaza or other areas?
Yeah, we definitely plan on being here for as long as possible or as long as it takes. We're going to continue occupying Cesar Chavez Park. Obviously, we will continue cooperating with the Sacramento PD and the media and the city. So we're going to be here. We're not going anywhere.
Well, thank you both so much. Aria Rashid and Aninda Chowdhury, they're both with Occupy Sacramento. They joined us via cell phone from downtown Sacramento. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, the 100th anniversary this month of California women getting the vote. You'll hear the story of how that happened, and we'll discuss the state of women's political rights and influence today. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio, I'm Jeffrey Callison. Here's your weather. In Sonora today, it'll be sunny and reach 67, but cooling down to 43 overnight, so you'll probably want to wrap up for what might be a slightly chilling event this evening in Columbia State Historic Park, that's just north of Sonora. It's the Stories and Stone Cemetery Tour. You'll stop at the graves of people who died in the area and hear about their lives. The tour is a fundraiser for the Friends of Columbia State Historic Park. And the weather tomorrow in the Sierra will be nice for two long, very scenic bike rides around Quincy. Mostly sunny there tomorrow with a high of 71 expected for the Indian Valley Century Rides. One of those rides is 100 miles long, the other 100 kilometers. Both start in Greenville, north of Quincy at 7 a.m. and will wind through the Plumas National Forest. Today's sunny high in Sacramento, 72, 73 in Marysville, 65 in Grass Valley, 59 in Carson City, and 52 in South Lake Tahoe. It's going to be sunny and a bit warmer over the weekend. October 10th, 1911, was a rather significant day in California political history. Not only did voters, all men at that time, give themselves the right to put initiatives on the ballot and recall elected officials, they also changed the state constitution to give women the right to vote. All that was 100 years ago, and there are various events planned and underway commemorating the extension of women's suffrage in California. One of those events is an exhibit at the State Capitol Museum. It's called We Won the Vote, 100 Years of Equal Suffrage in California. And the interpretive specialist and researcher on that exhibit is with us. She's Debbie Hollingsworth of California State Parks. Debbie, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
As I understand, the vote was pretty close back in 1911.
The vote actually passed by about 3,500 votes.
And if I read correctly somewhere, there were several counties in California that actually voted against it, including San Francisco and Marin and Alameda. So that was kind of an interesting change of political turns in those counties.
It is interesting. The larger areas did vote against women's suffrage. The vote was actually carried in the rural areas.
How controversial was it at that time extending the vote to women?
It was a difficult. Men and women had their own spheres that they occupied, and it was difficult for women to express that, to pass into the public realm. It was, women were out, they were speaking on the street corners, they were trying to gather that support for the vote. And it was controversial for them at the time.
Also with us is Alana Jadel, who's a professor of political science at American River College and organizing a women's suffrage event at Sacramento State next Tuesday. Alana, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Although women were heavily involved in the suffrage movement, of course, it is a little ironic that in the end it was up to the men who voted at that time to decide whether or not they were going to get the vote.
Of course, it was extremely controversial, and that was the case in California and in every state, and ultimately at the level of the U.S. when women were granted the vote via the 19th Amendment. It was all in the hands of men. It was men that gave women the right to vote, and it was an extremely difficult road that they forged from 1848 on.
California was not the first state to give women the vote.
Correct. Utah was in 1890, and that was largely not for terribly progressive reasons.
Oh, really?
Utah gave women the right to vote largely to protect polygamy. It would increase the number
goodness.
Of female Mormon voters. So.
Oh, wow.
We were just talking in the
this
green
is Kim
room
Nalder about, of Sacramento State.
Yeah, about how my great-great-great-grandmother was one of the chief suffragettes in Utah. Oh. And I have a picture of her with Susan B. Anthony, which is kind of special, but it's mixed because it really was also tied in with polygamy.
Right, yeah. Right. And a lot of the Western states were not necessarily super progressive, like Idaho, and they
Wyoming.
Were just, right, trying
they had
to
had their own reasons for doing
yes.
this.
And that's why California, why the vote in California was so important, because it really set the stage. It was such a large, progressive important state, and it was the largest state to pass women's suffrage at the time.
And it was crucial because when women gained the right to vote in California, it increased the number of electors mm-hmm. At the presidential level that they would control. And so that really altered the landscape for women's political voice in demanding the vote at the federal level, because they now, in fact, in the 1916 election, there's some evidence that women actually altered the outcome in California, and Wilson won the election because of women and because of women voting in California.
We're talking about the 100th anniversary of women getting the vote in California. The actual date is on Monday, October 10th, because there was a vote of in California on that date in 1911. Kim Nalder, I was looking at some of the arguments by lawmakers at that time, and J.B. Sanford, the chairman of the Democratic Caucus, argued against women getting the vote. And he started his argument by writing, "Suffrage is not a right. It is a privilege that may or may not be granted." What do you make of that?
With any political struggle, the powerful try to maintain their power. And so that's yet another example of that. These women must have been incredibly frustrated at their inability to get the movement through as quickly as possible. In 1896, there was a major attempt to get the vote for women in California that was rebuffed. And so this was, you know, yet again coming back and trying to convince the men that, that women deserved that privilege. And a lot of the arguments that were made at the time weren't really about sort of civil rights or equality. They were about, you know, extending the duties of the household to the larger household, which is the state. They were very, you know, retrogressive in a lot of ways.
Were they concerned, some of the men at that time, were they concerned about this influence that women might have in politics that, that Alana was alluding to?
Right. So one of the main concerns was that there's this image of women as being sort of agents of cleanliness, right, in the political realm as well, right? That the prohibition was the main concern, and that's one of the reasons that that
women were really the leaders in that.
Right. Right. So the prohibition movement was largely tied up with the suffrage movement, and that's one of the reasons that San Francisco, you know, defeated it heavily because there were a lot of bars and brothels too. So prostitution was one of the issues, and there was this conception that, that women might do away with some of the old boys clubs and the power centers that previously existed that were comfortable for some people.
Speaking of prohibition, Debbie Hollingsworth, there was an earlier campaign in California to extend the vote to women in 1896, but it faced major opposition from a big industry.
It faced major opposition from the liquor industry. And as we talked about earlier, San Francisco, one of the reasons in San Francisco was it had one of the largest immigrant populations in the state, with Germans and Irish in particular. And they were actually closely associated with the liquor industry at that time.
Was this because women were associated with the prohibition movement and the liquor industry was worried that if women could vote, that it would be bad news for
correct.
The liquor industry?
Yes, yeah. Correct.
Well, that's an interesting aspect to this whole thing.
Yeah, it's at the national level, too. The liquor industry is very against women getting the right to vote.
Alana, could you talk more about what influence came to be seen in California and, I guess, in the United States as women started to vote and then took office?
Right. Well, actually, initially, women don't really vote very differently than men, and women don't vote in very high numbers. It's not until 1980 that women start to outpace men in terms of
1980.
Women vote almost identical to their husbands or partners or men in their lives. And it's not until the 1980s that women start to vote at similar numbers. And now women vote in greater numbers than men in elections.
And
by a significant amount, by like, you know, about 56%.
So what changed, Kim, in 1980 or the 80s?
Well, what changed is that, you know, there was this gradual progression. When women first got the ability to vote, clearly they didn't have a cultural expectation that they would be participants. And that took some time to evolve. And so we don't see the crossover until 1980. But it's partially because of the culture.
Well, and I think it's also a result of, if you look at the 60s and 70s, the social movement atmosphere of the time, which encouraged women's participation. And then that third wave of the women's movement emerges in the 1970s out of the civil rights movement. And you have women feeling really frustrated and oppressed that, yes, they have the right to vote, but there's all these other rights they don't have. And yet again, they're being put on the back burner in front of African-Americans are being given all these rights and they're not. And so there's this kind of frustration among women, and they start to, you know, form the women's movement becomes very active in the 70s. And then by the 80s, you've got more and more women with education, with cultural expectations that have changed. This cultural revolution has taken place in the United States that allows, I think, or pushes
and,
women
And there
out.
Was a sort of sense of civic duty and civic pride, and a lot of the women's organizations had been encouraging that for decades already. But we see that finally bleeding into the public sphere in a full-throated way in the 1980s.
I was looking at a list, a table showing how many women lawmakers there are in different parts, in parliaments and so on around the world. And even in the place where women have the largest number of lawmakers, which is Northern Europe, the Scandinavian countries, it's still less than 50%.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to say what those women from 100 years ago, the suffragettes, would have made of all that. But what do you think, Kim? Do you think they would be surprised that women are not a bigger force yet politically?
It's hard to imagine that they wouldn't be disappointed, at least. I can't imagine that they would have been surprised given what they went through. But disappointment that 100 years later we would still be in a state of, you know, lacking full equality, full representation. I mean, even in the California state legislature, we're at about 28%. And state legislatures tend to be higher than national. It's about double. but nevertheless, it's still not 50-55% like it would be if it was representative.
And yet, Alana, let's note, though, as our program wraps up, that the Nobel Peace Prize is shared today by Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, president of Liberia. I understand the first democratically elected woman president in Africa. So I guess that's a sign of progress.
Well, it's certainly a sign of progress, and I was very excited to hear that this morning. Maybe not so much in terms of women's rights, but also in terms of the peace process and what she has tried to do in Liberia, which was a horrifically war-torn country and a lot of horrid acts done towards women. But it is a sign of progress, and I am excited.
Well, for more information and more discussion about women's vote, you can go to Sacramento State next Tuesday evening. It's an event that Alana has helped organize. It's from 6 to 8 p.m. in the University Union Ballroom. The keynote speaker is California Secretary of State Deborah Bowen. There'll be a general discussion about women's rights. There's also at the State Capitol Museum this ongoing exhibit about 100 years of equal suffrage. And very quickly, Debbie Hollingsworth, on October 15th, there's going to be a living history program, right?
Our volunteers have living history, and they will be recreating some of the arguments that the pro and con arguments for the vote.
And they'll be in period attire?
They will be dressed in period attire, signs, everything.
And in the exhibit that runs through next September, there's historical photographs, period campaign materials, and so on.
We have so many amazing items in this exhibit to see, and everyone's very excited. It's a beautiful exhibit.
And there's no cost.
Well,
thank you so much for joining us. Our guests, Debbie Hollingsworth of California State Parks, Kim Nalder of Sacramento State, and Alana Jadel of American River College. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's Insight for today and for this week. We'll be back next week. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Thanks for listening to Insight.